It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Molly of Denali is a new kids cartoon TV show from PBS that's based around an Alaska Native community. We'll talk to some of the show's creators. First, if you've ever had learning a new language on your project list, you probably know it can be a big undertaking. There are things like figuring out how to roll your R's or understanding verb conjugation, and of course, finding time to focus on learning in the first place. But our next guest says there's also lots of joy to be found in the process, and she's here to share some advice on how we can start learning a language at any age. Sage Gellner is an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. She's also the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. Sage, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Judith, for having me on.
Well, we've recently asked our listeners to tell us about things that they were learning, and language came up from a couple different people. Here's what Eva in Greendale told Central Time host Rob Ferret about why she started learning Korean.
I recently got into K-pop, and usually that's a frowned upon reason to start learning Korean. But I started listening to the music, and I fell in love with the beauty of the language and how complex it was. So I looked into it, I found an app, and some of my friends are learning it too. So I've decided to learn it from them and to use this app to challenge myself and challenge my thinking, especially over this summer.
That's such a cool reason for learning a particular language. What are some of the other reasons you hear from people about why they want to start learning a new language?
I just want to commend the person who's learning Korean and say that K-pop has been really influential in Korean enrollments in our evening programs. Korean is having a resurgence. So there's a proverb that goes that you live a new life for each language that you speak. And that's really, I think, one of the main reasons people want to learn new languages. In the courses I teach and oversee, a lot of people are traveling and they want to be able to connect more deeply with the people and the cultures.
Actually be able to interact.
Yeah. Be able to interact. Traveling to places like Italy, France, and my colleague does courses in Spanish, so Spain and Latin America. Definitely, that's a reason. There are also ancestry reasons. Many of our many people in Wisconsin have German heritage and want to learn about their family tree. Want to read old letters, so they will pick up German. Those are just some of the many reasons.
And does it matter why we want to learn, how we might want to go about it? Like if it's for travel, maybe we want to focus on really useful everyday terminology. But if we're like really drawn to maybe a form of literature, that's a very different type of language. Is that something to take into account when you're deciding?
Absolutely. I think not only you want to think about the language that pulls you, that calls you, but also the reasons why you want to learn it and to make that endeavor meaningful to you. So if your goal is to read Proust, then you're going to be your learning style. You're going to tailor your learning style differently. You're going to do a lot of reading as opposed to listening, for example, working on your vocabulary and such. If your goal is to communicate with your mother-in-law, because that's another reason people learn a language is because they have bicultural spouses or families, the things you are learning will be different, but the key is to make it meaningful for your learning.
What are some realistic goals to set as we're starting out learning a new language? I mean, reading Proust is a pretty lofty goal. and I studied Russian for a long time, and there's a lot of Russian literature that I know I am never going to be able to read. I'm never going to be at that level. What are some good, really concrete goals that we can feel a sense of accomplishment fairly quickly?
Well, I think goal setting is great, and keeping them easy and fun, keeping your preliminary goals easy and fun is really key. Greetings, weather, colors, feelings, These are things that we can attain easily. And I also think memorizing the words to your favorite song in the language you're studying is a nice goal to have. And really, when you're starting out learning a language as an adult, I think it's really helpful to start with listening and to just have music, news, podcasts, all kinds of, you know, audio in the background, because our brains really need to get used to the sounds and rhythms of the new language.
We're talking with Sage Gellner right now. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the joy of learning languages at a, we'll say, older age, out of school age, and ways to go about it, because it can be a little intimidating. So, Sage, let's say I wake up tomorrow. Actually, every day I wake up and think that I would love to study a new language. What if I think, okay, this is the year I'm going to do it. I'm going to start. What's a good way to start?
I start by taking the first step, whatever that is for you. If it's tuning your radio to your favorite station, whether it's signing up for the evening class, whether it's finding a language table in your community, or looking on meetup.com for a language partner. It could be, the first step could be labeling your silverware in the target language and your household furnishings.
There used to be a whole series of workbooks that had those stickers for everything.
Yes.
And I never used them all, but I just, you know, had this image of like, you literally couldn't look at anything or pick up anything without a little label.
That's right.
On your toothbrush and on the oven and things like that.
And not just reading it, but saying it
right
when you touch it. Yeah.
So what if we maybe studied a language years and years ago in school, but haven't really done anything with it? Does that give you a little bit of a leg up if you go back to it, even if it's decades later?
Absolutely. I have an older gentleman who came back to French, took a course with me at the French House after 40 years, I think. He had taken French in high school and not spoken a word of it since. And he had a wonderful time just reconnecting with the language and remembering things and the fun turns of phrase and the ways that we express things differently in different languages.
Is there something to be said for learning a language because we want to instead of because we have to? I'm thinking, you know, yes, maybe there are quizzes and tests in the maybe the app that you're using to learn or the class that you're taking, but that's not going on a report card that is, you know, going to follow you for however long. It's a way to gauge yourself, but it takes some of the pressure off.
Yeah, I think I feel that a lot, that intrinsic motivation, because I work mostly with returning adult students and they want to come to this class because they want to learn French. And same goes for my colleagues in German and Spanish and Portuguese and the whole list of the languages that we offer at UW in the evening classes, continuing studies. It's really that meaningful motivation that really keeps you connected with your project of learning your language.
Let's go to the phones, and Judy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Judy.
Hello there.
Hi, what would you like to share?
I would like to share that I am having a marvelous time learning sign language with one of my grandchildren. We now play games like Go Fish, using sign numbers to ask for each other's cards and the fish sign for Go Fish. But it's more than that, and I just picked up a book, brought it over there. When we're together, we learn some vocabulary, and I think it's been a great way, and I know it's learning a language is preventative for Alzheimer's, so all good.
That's wonderful. How old is your grandchild that you're doing this with, Judy?
We started this when she was 4.5, and she will be 7.
Wow.
So we have quite a vocabulary that we can share.
And had you always been interested in sign language? How did you choose that language in particular?
It was more, what would I have time to do? And because I do babysit with her, I had the time already in my calendar. So it was perfect. Besides, she's very quick and she loves it.
Wow. Well, that's just a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that with us, Judy. Sage, that hits so many of the great reasons to share with someone you care about, to, as she said, prevent, decline mentally. Mm-hmm. And now I'm sure that Judy can also interact with deaf people who she wouldn't normally be able to communicate with.
And I think that's a language that we often overlook. American Sign Language, and there's a great need for interpreters and people who can speak that language. I also think it's a really fun language to think about learning, because it's motion and speaking. And so when we're thinking about cognitive benefits of learning things as we age and neuroplasticity of the brain, combining movement with language learning is really powerful.
We're talking with Sage Gellner right now. She's Associate Professor of French and Continuing Education at UW-Madison. We're talking about how to learn a new language at any age and why it can be a great way to spend your time. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you learning a new language right now? If so, how's it going? What challenges have you run into? If you want to learn a new language but haven't quite gotten started, what are some of the things that have gotten in your way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about learning a new language with Sage Gellner. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison and the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to learn a new language as an adult? Were there learning techniques or tricks that worked really well for you, or maybe some that didn't? What questions do you have for Sage about how you can start trying to learn a language on your own? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we heard that little clip from our listener, Eva, from Greendale earlier. She mentioned a language app that she's using. What do we know about how useful apps and other software is for language learning?
We know that they can be very useful as additions to your project. My students swear by Duolingo. They use it, and it's a fun little app. It's free, and it gamifies your learning experience. So you actually level up, and if you don't do the app one day, the owl gets a sad face, and so it incorporates that sort of play into the language, and so there's that one, but there are myriad other apps that can help, and just what we can do with technology these days. There are YouTube tutorials on pronunciation of certain things that are hard for English speakers to do, for example. Podcasts. It's pretty exciting.
I've also heard there's something that I think it's called Slow News, and I think it's in not a lot of languages, but it's current events news at half the speed, I believe. So if you want to kind of incorporate staying up to date on what's going on in the world, but also practice your language, it sounds like there are things like that as well.
That's a fantastic resource, and one that I recommend often. And the reason why I recommend it, why it works so well, is that it stays when you're learning something new. There's the comfort zone, there's the learning zone, and then there's the panic zone. And when you listen to real time, let's say Spanish news, you're in the panic zone. You're not getting it. And we don't take into account the role that emotion can play in our language learning. So the news in slow French or news in slow Spanish is great because it's right in our learning zone. And there's even a transcript of the spoken part, so you can go back and catch things you might have missed.
And I will say that one of the best situations, and it's not always easy to find, is when you can watch a movie in a language that you're learning and see subtitles in that same language instead of in English. So it's the same kind of thing. You're hearing it and you're reading it. And they don't always match up. I have noticed that.
Yeah.
But that, to me, I always know that I'm learning in those situations.
Yeah, that's really helpful because, as you know, the reading skills come faster generally for people than the listening skills. So to have that extra scaffolding in the form of the subtitle is great.
We're talking with Sage Gellner right now about learning languages as an adult. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Jerry in Johnson Creek. Hi, Jerry. Oh, we lost Jerry. Let's go to Ben in Toma instead. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to live and work in Peru a while ago, and I learned Spanish, you know, via just immersion, and it was rapid, you know, 3 months really uncomfortable after that. It was good, but then I came back, I wanted to learn, you know, something else, and I was looking into German, but I just find it so difficult to, you know, learn the language without somebody to speak it with, without, like, that immersion experience that I had when I was in Peru, and I kind of just dropped it, unfortunately. But then what would you say, like, what kind of resources are there out there for you know, looking for, like, a language partner or someone to speak the language with, people like me who want to learn but find it difficult without that?
Sure. Thanks for that, Ben. And yeah, definitely there's nothing like an immersion experience, but for many, many reasons, that's not always possible. What's kind of the next best thing, Sage?
So you mentioned a language partner, and I talked about meetup.com earlier in the program. I think I haven't explored this, but I think there are virtual conversation partners. You can you can meet with people either for free or for a small fee via Skype or other video conferencing. There are people who do that professionally now. That's like one-on-one tutoring. So that's one way. And another thing that I think we don't think about often is foreign exchange students. It's a way to, if you can't go there, it's a way to bring your target language and your target culture to you. Of course, that person, that youth is wanting to learn English,
right.
So you're not going to be speaking German the whole time. But it just puts you in that sort of bilingual or thinking about how do I say this in German mindset. And you don't have to do a program for a whole year and invite somebody for a whole year. There are summer, you know, month-long programs, things like that. So
great. Well, good luck with that. And we do have Jerry on the line, so let's go to Jerry in Johnson Creek. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
It's really an excellent program to listen to, and your speaker is right on. I am 70 years old. I started to study Spanish a year and a half ago, and I use multiple tools to learn. Sometimes I will spend 8 hours a day just learning it because it's so exciting and fun.
Wow.
But Duolingo is absolute. I've used many, and I still use many apps. Duolingo is absolutely the best. I have a tutor in Costa Rica. I read all sorts of books. I finally met a neighbor while I was on my bike who is Mexican. She's coming over here tomorrow morning so that we can talk to each other.
And Jerry, I'm going to tell you something. We were actually going to play a clip of you calling into the show when we talked about learning new things. And you talked exactly about learning Spanish. And that was one of our inspirations for doing this segment. So thank you for that. And Jerry is having a great time learning Spanish, it sounds like.
Yes, Jerry, you're doing it. Just the way you need to do it. A lot of times I think we want to have a silver bullet or a one-size-fits-all approach to, oh, if I just go to X country for 3 months, I'll be fluent. And that's not the case. It's exactly what Jerry's doing. It's taking a multiple pathways to in this pursuit of this meaningful project for you and having fun while you're doing it.
And I will say one of the most important things I have found in trying to, you know, increase how proficient I am in a language is not being afraid to make mistakes. You just have to speak.
That's right. Yes. Speak before you think you're ready to say something. don't be afraid to make those mistakes, and we can laugh about it and find the fun in it. I think that's where kids do have an advantage, because they're fearless and they don't mind making mistakes. And that's actually where my 60-year-old students also have an advantage. They know how to laugh at themselves and how to pick up and dust themselves off and try again.
Let's go back to the phones, and Amy in Door County is next. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I really respect people that can speak more than one language. I've always felt inhibited to give it a try, post-high school, because I would say I know for a fact I don't have a great memory. It feels kind of necessary in learning a new language.
Sage, are there techniques that you give your students to maybe, if people feel like they're just not soaking it in like we feel like we do when we're a kid?
I think everybody's brain is different. And it sounds like you know your learning style, and you know that it's a challenge for you to remember things. So the key there would be practice and persistence for you, and not to take it too seriously. If you forget something that you've learned already 7 times, you've forgotten it, and maybe you'll learn it on the 8th time. Our last mistake is always our greatest teacher.
One of the other things that people can sometimes find difficult, I think, learning a language at an older age is, for instance, some of the things like rolling an R or being able to actually hear exactly what a native speaker is doing with their mouths. Are there any tips for that?
I think, again, practice and persistence are key. Watching yourself pronounce things in the mirror can be very helpful. Imitating, as I said, those YouTube tutorials can help. And again, working with a native speaker. It's okay to have an accent. It's beautiful to have an accent. It's charming to have an accent. We shouldn't try for perfection.
Exactly. And it's pretty unlikely that you won't have an accent. So just
exactly.
accept
yeah.
it and move on.
Yes.
Well, Sage, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
It was fun for me, too. Thank you very much.
That was Sage Gellner, an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison and the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. She was with us today to talk about the joy of learning a new language and how to get started. And you can still share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you picked up a language? What did you do to get started? How have you continued? And what have been some of the joys in being able to communicate with other people? Do you feel different when you speak a different language? I know I do. You can do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you're thinking. Coming up after the news, we talk with some of the creators of a new PBS Kids cartoon show about the life of an Alaska Native girl. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the impact on the stock market of the latest trade tensions between the U.S. and China, and why the President and Treasury Department are now calling China a currency manipulator. First,
let's go!
She's Molly of Denali. By plane, a sled, or snowshoes, she is ready to explore. From Cactova down to Juneau, always wanting to learn more. Together with her best friend, Tui, always by her side.
And Dreamy.
Discovering the outdoors on adventures day and
That's a little bit of the theme song for a new PBS cartoon series for kids. It's called Molly of Denali. As the name suggests, Molly is a girl living in Alaska, and the show follows her as she creates a video blog about her life in a fictional Alaskan village. Molly's cultural heritage draws from several Alaska Native groups, and PBS says that the show is the first nationally distributed kids series to have a lead who's an Alaska Native. The show went to great lengths to bring Molly and her community to life as accurately as possible. To learn more about it, we have co-creator and executive producer Dorothea Gillum with us. Hello, Dorothea.
Hello.
And we also have Rochelle Adams joining us. She's a member of an Alaska Native advisory group that worked on the show. Welcome to you as well, Rochelle.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Let's start with you, Dorothea. Where did the idea for Molly come from?
Well, I grew up in Rochester, New York, which is known for many things, including a grocery store called Wegmans, which I don't think you guys have out in Wisconsin, but it's really more than a grocery store. It's kind of the hub of the community. And I always wanted to do a kids show about a store. Kids love playing stores, so it seemed like a fun place to be. And when I was thinking about where this store could be set, Alaska was in the news. This was back in the summer of 2015. So knowing nothing about Alaska, I thought, yeah, that would be fun. And the store morphed into a trading post, and, you know, the idea kind of evolved from there.
And tell us a little bit more about Molly and the premise of the show. So her family runs this trading post, and she's learning about her culture. But what happens in the segments?
Well, a lot happens. It's an action-adventure comedy, so it really follows the daily life of Molly, which is pretty cool when your backyard is, you know, the beautiful and wild Alaska, and when you are a modern village kid. And so we learn all about Molly's culture. And the stories range from sort of, simple stories about when Molly catches her first fish to more epic adventures when she gets, separated from her dog and she has to sort of, you know, make her way through blinding snowstorms. So it's really, it's just a fun glimpse into the everyday life of a young girl in interior Alaska.
And Rochelle, you are part of the advisory group that is ensuring that Molly's story and the show are accurate and appropriate and respectful. What brought you to this project? How did you get involved?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, I have to say it has just been such an honor to be a part of this whole thing. I became involved when, you know, Dorothea mentioned they were looking at Alaska, wanted to do a story about someone around a trading post and, you know, wanting to do something outdoorsy. And looking at, I think that was around the same time that Denali got renamed back to Denali from Mount McKinley. And so they were looking at the area and the indigenous tribes of that around the area are the Athabascans, and they needed cultural experts. And so I'm very happy to have been asked, you know, as a cultural bearer and artist and a linguist, and was just so happy to have that, you know, opportunity, because growing up I hadn't ever seen anything, you know, that represented my people accurately in the media or anything like that. And so I also thought, what a great, you know, opportunity to educate people about Alaska, our state, and all of our beautiful indigenous cultures and celebrate our diversity. So I'm very happy.
And Rochelle, you said that you had never seen accurate representations of your life and your culture.
Yeah.
What were some of the representations that you did see growing up that just didn't ring true to you at all?
Yeah, well, you know, growing up, I was a bit confused because I didn't see anyone that represented me on TV. And what I did see in the media was, you know, like squaws and kind of stereotypical racist sort of things. And I was confused because I couldn't connect with them. And I just didn't see that for in my own life. So basically, it was like we didn't exist in the media. And therefore, I think that's how a lot of the misconceptions about Alaska and indigenous people is people aren't aware that we're actually alive, and still here. And, you know, we have many cultures up here in Alaska. There's 20 distinct Alaska Native groups and languages with different dialects. But, you know, people still have that misconception that we're all Eskimos and live in igloos, you know, and... Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's wrong. And so it's been such a pleasure just to be able to share, you know, how we live up here and how diverse it is and beautiful. And there's been, you know, indigenous people at all levels of production. And so it's been really amazing to have that, you know, have our people be truly represented in an authentic way.
We're talking with Dorothea Gillum and Rochelle Adams. They are both involved in the creation of the new PBS Kids show, which is called Molly of Denali. It's about a Native Alaskan girl and her family. And one of the things I really like is that you are clearly hoping to give kids who are not, and adults for that matter, who are not Native Alaskan, a glimpse, an accurate glimpse into that life, but also not assuming that it's not Native Alaskan kids who are watching the show either. So I know that there's one episode where a visitor has all these incorrect ideas of what life in Alaska is like, but also Molly and her friends have really funny ideas of what life in Texas is like.
Yeah. Yeah, that episode is hilarious. And, you know, it really is kind of talking about, you know, don't believe everything you see in the movies, you know, type of thing. And I thought it was really interesting having, I did a screening out in Washington, D.C., and, you know, so far removed from Alaska. And, you know, the people, all the feedback I got was great. I mean, people were really connecting by watching an episode and just feeling that they belonged somewhere in Molly's community of Kaya, which is super diverse. And, you know, they all live in a very, it's very community-based and very based on our traditional values, which are universal values, and everyone can connect with those, you know, being respectful and sharing and having that strong sense of family. So it's really something that everyone can connect with, and not only Alaskan Natives or Indigenous people, but everyone. Yeah.
Let's listen to a clip from Molly of Denali. In this scene, Molly is trying to find a book about Native names in the library, but is disappointed to find out that none exist.
This is important information. There should be books about it.
I agree, but no one has written one yet.
I guess I'll have to go around town and find out for myself.
Good luck!
My uncle gave me my Nupiaq name, Sanaururuk. He who is good at making things. I was named after him.
Because you carve things out of wood.
Shakayakhe. It means Auntie Big Shot leader, and I am.
So you're talking in the show about Molly's interest and drive to discover her heritage, the history of the Alaska Native community where she lives. Who is voicing the characters in Molly of Denali? Dorothea?
Well, Molly herself is voiced by a 14-year-old girl named Sovereign Bill, who is Tlingit and Muckleshoot. And most of the other actors are First Nations actors who, because our voice recording is based in Vancouver, where our animation studio is. We have one or two other actors who are also Alaska Native, but the majority, I would say, are First Nations. But it was really important to us that Molly herself was Alaska Native, and we went to great lengths to find her.
And Rochelle, what does it mean for you to hear and see the show and know that First Nation people were so involved in it and are involved in it as it goes forward?
Yeah, it means so much. I mean, really, I'm honestly still processing how amazing this is and far-reaching. And to be able to share it with my community, you know, in the villages in Alaska and all, just all the feedback that I've received is so wonderful. And people are, you know, have this excitement and pride in their, you know, in their culture and homeland, but also I'm very excited to hear the language being spoken, and to me that's really the best part of, you know, hearing kids connect with that, and, you know, kids that are learning their language. I've had one of my nieces was so excited when she heard them say Vadzai and Masi Cho, and she's, you know, because she's learning that too in her bilingual class. So to normalize our language is really our goal, and to get it, you know, out in our community and to be speaking it again. And really that shows, you know, how Indigenous people are still thriving and also living in a modern world. Like Molly has a blog, and, you know, she's a vlogger, and she uses informational text and the internet to do searches and gain knowledge and share things like in the book, you know, that she made for the native names. So it's just such a beautiful blend of indigenous and Western culture.
Well, thanks to both of you for sharing the story of Molly. And I think we're all looking forward to watching her adventures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dorothea Gillum, executive producer and co-creator of Molly of Denali, and Rochelle Adams, who is part of the show's Alaska Native Advisory Group. We talked with them about a new PBS Kids television series with an Alaska Native girl as the lead character. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest trade tensions between the U.S. and China. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, conspiracy theories have always been around, but today they care less about evidence and more about being repeated by as many people as possible. We'll find out why they're so persistent and what it means for our democracy. First, it's been a wild week for the stock market so far. On Monday, the Dow plunged by more than 750 points, though stocks do seem to have rebounded today. This comes amid renewed tensions with China over trade. Also on Monday, the Treasury Department designated China a currency manipulator. That's a term our government hasn't used towards a country since the early 1990s. In addition, new tariffs on the horizon may have investors feeling jumpy. Michael Wursthorn joins us now to take a look at the latest trade tensions and market reactions. He's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal covering the financial sector and markets. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Wall Street saw its worst trading day of 2019 so far yesterday. What happened?
So we had investors are really trying to get a sense of just how what these trade tariffs mean for companies, for the economy going ahead. And that news that came out then late on Monday about the Treasury Department labeling China as a currency manipulator didn't really help sort of the situation in the sense that investors have a lot of anxieties about where things go from here. You know, that said, Tuesday ended up being a much better day. All three major indexes had notched their biggest gains since June as investors took advantage of a slight lull in some of those trade tensions just because China didn't respond very forcefully at all to what the Treasury Department had did. And investors really took the opportunity to pounce on some stocks that had just gotten really beaten up over the last few days, especially on Monday with those deep declines.
Even if there is some level of recovery, is that volatility healthy?
That's an interesting thing. I mean, volatility in the market generally is considered to be a healthy thing. I mean, in the sense that of how we're seeing it now, it's certainly more exaggerated than we've seen in the last few months. And investors and other analysts are saying that that's going to likely continue. And that's just because we don't have a trade deal yet. I think investors are trying to avoid pricing in an optimistic trade outcome without seeing anything concrete. And we've done this a number of times. You saw it at the end of 2018 with markets really taking off and investors assuming that trade was going to reach a positive resolution. And that didn't happen, obviously, when May turned around and sort of sent the markets through that initial spiral when trade tensions resurfaced. And that's all happening again now. And I think investors are trying to be a little bit more mindful that not to expect a positive trade development until we actually see something.
On Monday, yesterday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin formally labeled China a currency manipulator. What does that term mean?
So basically, countries can weaken their currency by intervening in currency markets and purchasing U.S. dollars. There's been a major concern for several years amongst Washington of whether or not, you know, just how active China has been in this and how tightly they've been controlling their currency and the value of it. So with some of the moves, Treasury Department decided to come out and finally assign that label to China, and that's forcing some negotiations now between China and the U.S. about some of those currency manipulations. That's going to involve the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, as well, as they try to get to some sort of sense of how, you know, what exactly is going on, whether, you know, because China certainly does dispute whether or not it is manipulating its currency. So there's going to be an effort to understand what's really going on, and if there is an issue, to then resolve it.
You said that they had not really come back forcefully in response to this, but what has the response from China been to the accusation and being labeled a manipulator of their currency?
So, So basically right now, they've signaled they wouldn't let the currency fall much further. And that's sort of that was one of the calming factors in the markets today, that there wasn't going to be this effort to artificially prop up or move the currency beyond sort of what you see, you know, in the market on a day-to-day basis with currencies all around the world. So that decision in some ways surprised analysts and investors that, you know, Beijing could have responded much more forcefully or, you know, in a number of ways. And that could have been maybe escalating trade tensions or trying to initiate some of these other fronts involving, say, U.S. companies like Apple that it's threatened sometimes in the past. It didn't do any of those things. The central bank just came out saying that we're going to let the yen depreciate and not try to mess with it too much further right now.
We're talking with Michael Wursthorn right now. He's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal covering the financial sector and markets. And we're talking about the Dow going down significantly yesterday, rebounding some today, and China being labeled as a currency manipulator by the U.S. government. From what you've seen, is this constant back and forth between China and the U.S. over tariffs, over trade, over currency, is it causing a lot of unease for investors?
This latest episode certainly is. And it gets back to just that point that, you know, throughout much of this year, investors were fairly optimistic, especially coming off sort of how poorly 2018 ended up finishing with some of those steep declines you saw just around Christmas. So investors had a lot of optimism into this, and they want to see a positive resolution to trade. And I think that the problem was the longer there wasn't a headline or a tweet or some major new development on trade, the more investors were convinced that this is heading toward a resolution that's going to make everybody happy and sort of lift these tensions. You know, that said, I think investors are trying to condition themselves away from that, because this is becoming much more clear that trade tensions aren't going to end in 2019. A number of analysts are now expecting trade tensions to certainly continue into 2020. They're changing their forecast for corporate profits and how those could be impacted by trade tariffs in the rest of this year and in 2020 as well. So there seems to be a realization, at least now taking root in the market, more so now than certainly at the beginning of this year, that trade isn't going to be an issue that just goes away on its own, and that there needs to be a clear resolution before the market can optimistically say this is all over.
Well, and last week, speaking of those trade tensions and tariffs, last week President Trump announced a new wave of tariffs. This time they would be targeting $300 billion worth of Chinese goods, including some very significant consumer items like electronics and toys and apparel. These would go into effect starting September 1st, so less than a month away. What might that mean for the economy and for the stock market and for American consumers in the end?
And so those additional tariffs, that's basically going to put tariffs on pretty much all the imports that we're getting from China right now. And that's a pretty significant event. I mean, there's all different levels for how much those tariffs are actually being charged at. But this latest round really is going to hit consumers in their wallets in some ways. I mean, you're seeing the immediate reaction since the announcement in terms of shares of retailers, say from Best Buy to Macy's, all falling because investors are pricing in expectations that their profit margins are going to come down because of this. And for the only way for those companies and others that are affected by this, and you're seeing the same in the industrial space as well, along with manufacturers, if they don't want to absorb the higher prices and see their profit margins go down, the only other real option for them is to pass on those costs to consumers. And that means that we're going to see higher prices for a number of goods, you know, whether it is clothing, apparel, or food items and things like that, that people are now going to have to, at least for while this is all going on, get accustomed to paying a little bit more for. And that certainly seems to be something that companies are signaling right now, that they're willing and going to try to raise prices, at least marginally, to offset some of the higher costs that are associated with tariffs.
President Trump has said consistently that it is China and Chinese manufacturers who are going to bear the brunt of the tariffs. Briefly, Michael, is that true? It sounds like it's going to be the ultimately the consumers who pay the price.
I mean, unfortunately, in this case, I mean, a lot of analysts say that tariffs are basically just taxes, and consumers, unfortunately, end up being the ones to pay them because these are goods that are coming into this country. So U.S. companies have to buy them. They have to pay more for that. And either they keep those pricing, they stomach those price increases themselves, or they pass them on to the consumers. So this isn't hurting tariffs are certainly hurting China's economy overall, but it doesn't mean that U.S. consumers and U.S. companies are immune from those effects at all. They're very much feeling them, and you're seeing it, you know, already with agricultural products and U.S. farmers and just sort of the struggling that's gone on there, and that's why you've seen some relief come toward them. You know, with these new tariffs, I mean, retailers, manufacturers, and other companies are certainly bracing for a bit more of a tougher time in the rest of this year because they just can't avoid those higher costs. So,
and we'll leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. Michael Wursthorn is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal covering the financial sector and markets. He joined us to talk about the latest trade tensions between the U.S. and China and the stock market reaction and ultimately the impact on U.S. consumers. Commercials and marketing seem to be just about everywhere, and there's now another spot that you might run into ads in the future. That would be on the back of the fortune that comes at the end of dinner at a Chinese restaurant. A New York-based cookie company is creating branded messages for the back of fortunes and even tying them to the advice on the front. Like this example that the New York Post shared, one fortune reads, "Some things will be more obvious than others," followed by an ad for dentine ice gum on the back that reads, "Four people offered you gum today." Hint? The company making them is called Open Fortune and so far provides their cookies to about 19,000 Chinese restaurants. The cookies are a lot less expensive than the ones without ads since they are getting subsidized. I have to say, having worked in a Chinese restaurant on and off for about 10 years when I was in school, this hits pretty close to home. We had some rules about the many fortune cookies we ate. Like if you eat more than one cookie in a day, and let's face it, that was pretty common, only the first fortune counted. And if you got a cookie without a fortune, you got to make up your own. I'm pretty sure we came up with that because people would get a little freaked out if they didn't have a fortune in their cookie, so it was a good way to turn it around for a customer. I did develop the skill of opening fortune cookies and putting a different fortune into it. That can come in handy if someone wants to propose or announce a baby's on the way. Even though it's been years since I've done it, I kind of like to think of it as a kind of hidden superpower. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.